Hello, welcome to the Lately in JavaScript podcast. This is episode 22, I think. It has been a while since we started recording this podcast episodes. And as always, I have here with me our leader, Michael Kimsel. Hello, Michael. How are you doing?
Hi, Art.
Hello. You're really, really silly. I don't know how to shut it off now. There we go.
Hey, okay. Well, this is August. We've had, at least in my view, a slow month. There isn't many topics to talk about as in the previous months. I don't know. What do you think, Michael?
Well, I'm happy and excited. It's like a party going on here, and the whole neighborhood's invited. There's so much going on in the JavaScript community. Now, I sort of share your sentiment. I don't think I've slowed down, but it does feel like some things do slow down. So probably some vacation, and even if people aren't actually going away anywhere, maybe they're a bit more wrapped up with their kids, back to school stuff, things like that. So,
yeah. Well, but we still have some interesting topics to talk about. It's always good that even in a slow month, there is always some nice thing going on in the JavaScript world. And I think we could start by the JS Thumb project. Michael, you found out about this project. Do you want to highlight about it?
Yes, I did. I'm going to see if I can share my screen. Screen share, and where did it go? There we go. I'll just select share selected window. Can you see this up here?
Yeah, it's a bit blurred, but we can see it. But it's good enough.
The core, the name of this is JS Plumb with a B at the end, jsplumb.org. And this is a way of creating plumbing or pipes between different UI elements, and you can move them around, and the piping between them stays, it moves around and sometimes reorganizes itself. This is very reminiscent of about 6 years ago, the Yahoo pipes.
Yeah.
And I know when that first came out, there were people saying, ooh, can I use that same library? How do I do that? And I think there's been a couple other attempts over the years to try to recreate this. This one just came on my radar recently, and I thought I would at least share it. The interesting thing about this is that you can, if you see over here, you can use it with either SVG or Canvas. I'm not sure about, it says VML there too, but there are multiple options here. Also, there's some integration either with jQuery or MooTools or YUI3. So probably between those three libraries, likely one of those is something that you're using, unless maybe you're a hardcore EXT or Dojo person. That said, it's just a little something that it's kind of neat. I'm not sure that years ago, I think I would have had a direct use for this. And when I saw this, I thought, there's something I'm building, and it certainly doesn't require to use this, but can I? I probably won't use it for that particular project just because I'm on a deadline. But who knows? We'll cross that bridge when we come to it. Let me undo my screen share. There we go. Hello.
Yeah. Well, what I was wondering is if is this a generic audio? Block composition tool, because as far as I remembered, Yahoo Pipes was to combine sources of information like RSS feeds.
This is just the UI component of that. This is not doing any sort of a multi-stage processing or anything like that, or information filtering, cleaning like Yahoo Pipes was. This is just the visual UI component of things.
Yeah, so I think it probably can be used for more interesting purposes, because if it is that flexible and can be generic, I think people will appreciate it, and maybe you can see some surprising uses for this kind of library. Well,
yeah.
Well, okay, but moving on with our podcast, I would like to to continue and talk about a project that is somewhat similar to one that we actually even commented in the past. This one is called PHP.js, and there is also another project called PHP.js, which aims to be a virtual machine for executing PHP code from JavaScript, I think. And I was trying to use the screen sharing here. I'm not okay. I think it you can see it now. Anyway, we'll post the link to this project in the show notes. But what this the purpose of this is basically to have a PHP engine inside of a JavaScript program that you run in whatever environment you be running JavaScript, could be on the browser or maybe Node.js. And I don't know how far it has gone on the coverage of PHP features, but it says here that they passed 670 tests. I'm not sure if these tests are those that come with PHP suite of tests. And anyway, since this is not exactly new, because we already had a PHP.js project before, I wonder what this brings up as an alternative implementation, because it seems to be somewhat for the same purpose, or maybe I'm not getting this right. Michael, what are your impressions about this project?
Well, it's not that I'm trying to figure out what the purpose is. I mean, right from here, it says I lost it. Where was it? Reads code and transforms it to JavaScript. I was trying to find the usage here. Make me a new PHP engine, and in that PHP engine, you pass in some PHP code, and then you say, like in this case, engine VM output buffer, as it shows on the screen there. I would like to have seen maybe a larger use case. To be fair, he's got some sample code on here. Like here's sample PHP code, and you can run this. I'm trying to figure out what, if there's a good use for this, like a good practical use for it. And there may be, and it's just escaping me. But, you know, somewhat like, actually it's not, maybe not like CoffeeScript, but this idea of people saying, I'm going to have this, something that compiles onto something else so that I can write one language in another. CoffeeScript is probably a bad example because it's trying to just make JavaScript easier. Yeah. And this is more, I want to think about stuff in terms of PHP, but have it run in JavaScript. I wish I could see more of a, what particular use cases this might be used for. There probably are some, they're just not coming to mind.
Yeah, maybe they would just want to use some PHP library, for instance, with a Node.js environment.
That's the one thing that he says, though, is to not do. It says it probably will run, or it can run under Node, but don't do it. It can also be run on Node.js, but strongly recommended not to due to potential security issues. So I don't know if there's particular security issues more just with Node or with all JS engines, but if you're running it in the browser, for example, then it's maybe the implications are less. That to have a warning like that, but maybe not go into the reasons why was a little frustrating.
Well, I think the security issues they are bringing is to run arbitrary PHP, not some control PHP that you define.
But
user provided PHP, I think.
That idea of, what you were bringing up before about the idea of saying, well, let me run, let me use libraries, existing libraries. There probably are some out there that can be used in isolation, but for anything, I guess I can't think of anything offhand that would be, maybe there's some token, like language or like text parsing libraries and whatnot that you'd use, but it just feels like the majority of libraries I can think of are going to assume that they are going to have access to the file system or a database or something, Or that they're running in the context of a server as opposed to running in the context of a browser. I'm probably being overly critical of this. I don't mean to. I would like to have seen specifically some good practical, here's this library and now you can use this. Here's what you can do in your browser now specifically. But technically, the idea of it's parsing out it's tokenizing your PHP, creating, as it says here, building an AST tree. Technically, really awesome and very impressive.
Yeah, well, the only purpose that I probably see ever could be a good use is maybe to use some PHP library that for some reason does not exist an equivalent for JavaScript. And well, if it's not that, I really don't see much use of it other than being a cool project and not a trivial one, because it's not everybody that is skilled enough to build a language parser and a virtual machine to execute the converted code in a different language.
I guess one other thing that springs up, and I didn't see it addressed one way or the other. Now, interestingly, he has sample code for dealing with the magic methods in PHP, like call and get and set. In terms of kind of reusing existing code, there seems to be, at least with some of the major frameworks out there that are making reusable libraries, hey, you can use this. You don't have to use the Zen framework code in Zen framework. You can use it in your own package or your own project, for example. They're all going with namespaces now, and that was something I didn't see code supports namespaces or not.
Well, let's see if this project evolves somehow and gets some adoption.
Come back to it in a few months. Put it on the list.
Yeah. Moving on with our podcast, let's see if I can screen share. Okay, I think it is showing up. There is this new project from Google called Octane, which is basically to benchmark JavaScript implementations. I suppose that this is meant to evaluate how fast are JavaScript implementations on different browsers.
Yeah.
As you may be seeing on this screen, if you run this benchmark, I think it is testing real libraries. Not every kind of library, but some that they have picked, and they are evaluating how far it is running. Well, I just tested this in Chrome, but I suppose they probably want to compare it with, let's say, for instance, Firefox and Internet Explorer. I don't know what was the real purpose of this. This JavaScript benchmarks are not new.
Can I share my screen for a moment?
Yeah, sure. Just switch to yourself and talk.
I'm switching to myself. I want to share that one. Yeah, I'm going to share. Okay, I'm going to share that one first. This is my numbers. Oh, can I? And then I have to. What do I have to do? This. I don't know how to get mine in the main window.
I'm seeing yours when you talk. It's automatic.
Okay, because I'm not seeing mine when I now I see your face, but I'm going to turn my head and go back to the thing. Yeah. This is my Safari scores, and then. Screen share. Okay, that's that. Let me do screen share and show my other one. This is my these are my Chrome scores. You can see these are sometimes 3 to 10 times faster.
Yeah.
You say why would Google want to do this? Probably because these real world tests make Chrome look much, much better. Now, granted, I'm using that was Safari 5 on the Snow Leopard. I've not gone to 6. So I think there has been a lot of performance improvements in 6, but whether all these would perform, 3 to 10 times better, I don't know.
Yeah.
But anyway, I just wanted to share those that as a comparison on the same machine.
Right.
Yeah, to see what those numbers look like. And it was interesting to see your numbers in Chrome too.
Yes, it doesn't make sense to compare numbers in different machines.
Well, I mean, it just
they are different, the machines, I think.
I do understand that. It was still interesting to me because then I have an idea of how fast your machine is versus mine.
Yes, in that sense, yes. But I think for the purpose, it's just to compare. Well, in my opinion, it's to compare JavaScript implementations. And the purpose to that, coming from Google, either they are trying to say we are better, or they are trying to say, hey, competitors, wise up. You need to improve your implementations because you are lagging somehow. I don't know. What do you think about this? Could it be Google teasing the competitors?
It's probably a bit of both. It's now another benchmark tool that they sort of control. I mean, not that they're controlling all the tests, but they can now say, hey, this is here. Other people can use it. One of the flags here is that it's modern as opposed to maybe earlier benchmarks. What's the difference here between Octane and other things? Well, Octane aims to be representative of actual workloads. Many micro benchmarks, such as SunSpider, were written at a time when JavaScript wasn't used as extensively. And my microphone just fell. Pete Higgins, I think, had run from the Dojo group, Dojo Toolkit group, had written a benchmarking suite a few years ago that was running through a lot of quasi real world. It wasn't using a separate benchmarks like this, but it was doing different things and saying, if you want to do it with Dojo, this is this. If you want to do the same thing with jQuery, it's this. And it had the same kind of output of a bunch of squares on the screen. But that was probably 3 years ago. So there's probably some arguments to be made to continually have new benchmark suites that encompass whatever maybe state of the art libraries and functions are doing now in 2012 versus benchmarking loops from 2006. So
right, but I suspect that if this is taken, if this gets some attention, because since it's yet another benchmark tool, it may not get much attention because it's not exactly something new. But if it gets some attention, I guess probably Microsoft will come and say, "Oh, Google picked up a specific benchmark libraries on which their browser runs faster. We should be able to pick different libraries on which IE does." Somehow better.
But it would be interesting if they're open enough with this to include other tests that make them look not as good and maybe make IE look better or Opera look better. That would be the hallmark of openness, is if they say right here, well, you can file a bug about something. If the test code, they say if the test code can be packaged in a self-contained open source friendly way, we'll consider it for inclusion in the future. So maybe.
Well, I was trying to find out here, but usually these things are sort of open. I mean, open source, you can you can change things, but in the end, it's what is in their site that is being evaluated, regardless if other people evaluate other things. Anyway, I think this is, in my opinion, this is yet another tease from Google to other browser vendors too, so they can catch up on
catch up thing,
on doing things faster on their browsers, so the applications that traditionally look slow because of the JavaScript implementation being used on the specific browser, they start looking slow if the browser developers do an effort somehow, like Google has been doing, to make their browser much faster. Well, that's just an opinion. We do not see a specific comment on their real purpose, which leaves us just to wonder about it. But we are going to move on with another topic. This one, I need to explain something additional, but let me introduce first the topic, which is about a big video library.
Oh, okay.
Actually, that's what they call it, and I don't know if you can see the video that I have. It's probably slower than it's playing back here. It's quite smooth, although this machine is quite fast. I have seen it in a different machine. It's much slower. And anyway, just to explain to our listeners, this big video library is basically a jQuery plugin that can somehow make videos play on the background of page elements. I suppose they use the video element of HTML5, and well, the effect is really impressive, and just because it's not usual, but it pretty much seems like you are watching TV on the background of your page. And the reason that I wanted to comment about this, not just because it's impressive and probably is going to be a trend, Michael, I don't know if you noticed, there is a feature on Google Plus, like it was introduced like some weeks ago, about events. You can create an event on Google Plus.
Yeah.
And but that's nothing special. It's pretty much similar to events that you see on Facebook. But the detail that got my attention is that when you start, when you go to the Google Plus page, you can you create an event. I was trying to see if I could create it. Well, let me just describe it, and people can check it out later. You can pick a theme for the event, and usually it's a large background picture. And the detail is that the picture, although it seems to be a static picture, sometimes you notice something being animated on the picture, like some balloons on the wind or some candle moving somehow. And it's just a very small detail on the picture. And what somebody noticed that and asked me, "Oh, wow, how did Google is doing that? That picture is just being animated in that very small detail." It turns out that they are reusing MPEG for videos on the background. And if you have a HTML5 enabled browser, you see that animation as an alternative to a steady picture. For those that still do not have run an HTML5 enabled browser, they'll see just the steady picture. Mm-hmm. And it's quite impressive because it gets your attention if you look at it for a while. It doesn't start animating right away. It's not a big deal. It's just an unusual use of HTML video in web pages, thanks to HTML5, because video now became a standard page element. Okay. You don't no longer have to use Flash to show videos on page. And I don't know if you have noticed this feature of the Google Plus events. It's not about the events itself. It's just use video on the background, and it gives an impressive effect.
I haven't specifically seen it on the events, but I've seen. It wasn't the big video thing. I saw an announcement of that a few days ago. It wasn't specifically that, but I could swear that I've seen background images, like video in background images, a little bit more. I've seen it a few times over the past couple months, and maybe it was related to the release of this. Maybe it's something else. As we get standard, as more and more people have fast bandwidth as a standard, we'll probably see more things like this. And you know, the examples in your on your screen in that big video JS. Yeah, their entire move in the background. There's probably some uses for that, but we may see more of the subtle stuff. We may see more of the subtle stuff like Google is doing with their events.
Yeah. I think this may start to become a trend because nowadays people use a small animation effects to get the user attention, to make pages look more impressive. But if you start using video, even if there are small video clips just being animated on the background maybe not taking that much bandwidth because video is compressed, and if you just animate very small parts of the screen, it still gives a nice effect, and people may start using this as a means to impress the users.
Yeah.
That's my take on that. I'll talk a lot about the using video on the background, but didn't talk much about the library itself. It's, as I said, it's a jQuery plugin, and I just hope they don't use also audio to annoy the users in the background, although that's not exactly new. In the 90s, we already seen people annoying others with the lame background music. Oh wait, yours is not lame.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. That was. I just went to your webpage and music started playing. I don't know what happened there.
Okay. Well, anyway, the idea is just to not only show this library, but also maybe get people's attention. That's probably going to be a trend on a different way to get users' attention. And now I think a website are going to get heavier than usual. Well, anyway,
funny how you looked at me when you said heavier than usual. I was not excited when you said that.
You are always imagining things.
I can't believe you said that. Oh, you're going to make such a big fat deal about that. Yeah, I am. Yes. Okay.
Well, anyway,
are we going to look at the physics engine?
Yes, actually, I was trying to figure why I jumped the order.
Oh, you want to see? I'll show you my physics engine right there. Yeah. That was it. It's my physics engine.
Yeah. Well, anyway, that's now introducing the next the next topic. I'm just trying to get back to the screen sharing part. Okay, here it goes. This is an article. Not so much describing the all physics engines that exist, but providing a comparison between some of the well-known physics engines like Box2D Web, AMO.js, Jiglib.js, and Canon.js. And to tell you the truth, I actually only knew about Box2D Web because we even talked about it before, but the author goes through even some sample content to explain what are the features of these physics engines and how they are supposed to be used. Some are just 2D, others are 3D. The basic conclusion that comes to is that although it's nice to have these physics engines, which are basically means to animate elements on pages, I just say they are not enough mature, at least in his perspective, on the matter of what he expected them to be. I don't know. Since we didn't have physics engines in the past, I think having them now, it's great evolution. Physics engines have been used for very successful applications like Angry Birds. If that is not impressive enough, I think the author is expecting something much more impressive than we have seen so far. The author is Chandler Prowl, and I'll publish the link to this article for those that are interested to learn more about this physics engines comparison, read and learn what he's talking about. Michael, I don't know what were your impressions. Do you use physics engines for any purpose on projects?
No, I don't get that that advanced in things. It did seem to me, was it, because I was just going through these, testing them out, and it looked like the Box2D Web one, at least on my hardware, there was the best combination of speed and smoothness. A couple others seemed maybe slightly faster when there were smaller number of elements, but I just ran each example in my browser, and it may be that because I'm running them all on the same page, that maybe there's some conflict as well too. But it seemed that Box 2D seemed to be the best, again, given my hardware anyway. I don't know if there's any scientific stuff you can draw from that, but
yeah, well, I think some physics engines that you mentioned are not really comparable because they are meant for performing 3D animations. And 3D and 2D are usually for different purposes.
Sure, sure.
And other than that, as we have seen before, for fast machines, 3D engines, they are cool, but probably demand too much resources to be used in browsers. Although it's always nice to see this evolution, I don't think you can play complex 3D games using these engines.
Yet.
There
you go.
Maybe in the future we can... that will be common, and you probably enter to in a page on which you're being walked by a guest in three dimensions, all animated as if you are being received by a human.
Or a giant paperclip.
Oh, that could be. That would come from Microsoft, right?
Yeah. Hey.
They already had it in the past in 2D. Maybe now they're going to evolve and put it in 3D.
So we can see them rotating around from behind.
Dancing and stuff.
Okay. Okay. Maybe I shouldn't even go there.
Okay. I think we should not get involved in that area because our ideas are a bit lame. Okay. Never mind. Well, okay, moving on with the podcast, we're going to talk about now about an article that John showed on the JS Classes site. Actually, it was an article about a package by Ansel Hartmann from Switzerland. He developed this cross-domain Ajax package, and then he wrote this article. Actually, he wrote it right after he published the package, and only recently I have approved it because I was waiting for implementing a new feature on the site that when you approve an article published by an author, it is spread to the social networks using that feature of the site that allows any users to link their JS Classes site to Facebook or Twitter, and when new content like this is published, it gets reposted on their timelines in those social networks. And anyway, now that that's all implemented, I reviewed and approved this article, and it is basically to show Ansel's view on why it's implemented this cross-domain Ajax library, which is basically a way to send a sort of Ajax request. It's not exactly requested on via the XHR XML HTTP requests. It's just a way to fetch some JavaScript code on the server to maybe execute some part of a modular application and retrieve the code dynamically from the server. And in this article, he compares his approach with using JSONP, because JSONP is basically just a means to retrieve some data returned as a JSON object, and then have a callback function that you define on your browser side code to process that JSON data. And he compares this approach and makes some claims about advantages of using his cross-domain Ajax approach with using his article. Namely, he claims that JSONP is limited to retrieving JSON data, and if you want to actually retrieve some executable code, JSONP is probably not the most adequate method to do that. And he also claims about difficulties to handle errors using JSONP, although I think that it probably depends on the way you implement GSNP maybe is thinking about specific libraries. Because GSNP is just a protocol, and if there is error handling in the middle, I don't know if you can blame it to the GSNP protocol or some other, or an actual library that implemented it. Because maybe you can add some callback handler to handle errors, but that it's not a common usage way that libraries that implement GSNP provide. Michael, did you read this article? What were your thoughts?
I did read it, and I don't disagree with any of his conclusions. I'm not sure I had a whole lot to add. I did like the fact that in his cross-domain AJAX library that he pays attention to the error handling. As he points out, that JSONP itself, there's no standard mechanism for dealing with errors. If for some reason the server comes back with something else, you're left to deal with that on your own. As with a lot of AJAX sort of things, you end up building your own, or you end up either using something that you cut and paste or developing your own sets of libraries for idioms for dealing with for errors. So I like that he took that into account. Yeah, a lot of people will write a library and here's how to do the cool stuff and don't ever focus on how to deal with error conditions. So I thought that was almost a requirement, because if you're not going to do that, then I'm not sure that the library may have necessarily had as much use outside of the cross-domain stuff. So,
yeah, I think dealing with errors is a matter of maturity of the developers. Most developers, when they begin, they do not tend to do much error handling because it's boring. It's a part that they do not want to deal because, first, it's not usual to get errors. Errors are an exceptional situation. Mm-hmm. But, for instance, in the case of the AJAX requests or something, regardless of how they are implemented, I think in the worst case you should deal with timeouts, because if for some reason your server is not responding or the connection, the user internet connection dropped, and is left to wonder why it is not responding, it's not a good usability practice to not deal with at least timeouts.
The other problem, I think, I can speak from my own experience. When I know when I first started out, I didn't write any errors. I never had any errors. So just trying to say, how can my code break when it was so awesome to begin with? It was actually a struggle to write any error handling code for probably the first several years because because I was that good. Now, I know that's not a problem that you had. I know that's not a cross that you had to bear, so you probably can't relate. But there are probably some other people out there that can relate to the being as awesome as I am. Not easy.
And humble.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I didn't. Those weren't my words. Those are your words. Okay.
Right. Well, anyway, personally, maybe I'm not the best person to talk about, because I do not write so much JavaScript code directly. Mm-hmm. But usually it's something that comes from the server, usually in PHP. And many years ago, I developed a forms library in PHP that a great part of its purpose was to generate JavaScript to be run on the browser side to make applications more usable. And it comes with a plugin to perform AJAX requests. Actually, they are sort of emulated AJAX requests using iframes, which is basically a similar approach to Ansel's component. And but if for some reason there was an error, like the server has a bug and generated some invalid JavaScript and it returned an error in the browser, and the condition that would tell that a response has been loaded would never happen. And the way that I dealt with it, with that situation, was to implement a callback that would be executed after a given timeout period. And the default implementation of the callback function would just show a message to the user, or for some reason there is a problem, a communication with the server. And well, it is, at least it is some feedback. Usually you could probably give more instructions to the user. Oh, maybe you need to reload the page or come back later or go complain to somebody else. Or at
send
least
me money.
The user,
yeah.
Right, send me money and I fix it.
Yes. Interesting having a built-in bug reporting system with an app that also had some sort of a PayPal integration to it would be really, really interesting. I'm saying that somewhat tongue-in-cheek. I don't know how you actually talk that way. It's interesting. I've never seen payment, I guess bug bounties are sort of that way, but the idea of saying, when you submit a bug report, PayPal me $30 and that'll put you at the top of the queue.
Yeah.
That would probably be an interesting thing to do, but
yeah.
Developers, they're so, money is so below their, it's just outside of their thinking.
They don't like money. They just want to code and they are happy.
Yeah. Because all their MacBooks just come for free. Speaking of timeouts, let's move on to the next section. See how that did that transition?
Yeah.
That was awesome.
Before moving to the next section on which we are going to comment about the latest classes published in JS.
That's what I was...
Classes. In the podcast, that's the regular section that comes after this. But it's related. I just wanted to leave a note to encourage developers not only to publish their packages in the JS classes site so we can talk about them, but also write articles about them, because if they write articles on the site, for those that are not aware, each package that is published on the site is associated to an internal blog on which you can publish articles to tell more about your packages and so the users can learn more about it. But if your article is interesting, is not so specific to your package, and you can teach people more about generic stuff somehow related to your class, but it's useful for everybody, you can write an article, and you can flag an option there is in the article submission form that requests the article to be featured. And when the article is featured, it will show on as if it was part of the main JS classes site blog. And that's what happened with Ansel's article. The article became featured, and it was also syndicated by other sites that aggregate feeds from sites from the JavaScript world, like the Planet JavaScript aggregator. And your article also gets visibility there. So that's a way for you to get more exposure. And now, finally, moving on to this upcoming session of the podcast, we are going to talk about some of the latest packages published in the JS classes site. And as I said before, this was a sort of a slow month, probably because everybody is on vacation, probably in a warm beach, and they don't want to bother with programming because they are on vacation. But there were still a few packages that we are seeing that were posted here in the latest packages published in the JS classes site. And given that, Michael, would you like to start talking about the packages that you
maybe
found more interesting? Maybe.
if you would just keep your hair on for a minute. First, screen check. Oh, my goodness, all this traffic.
You are in your vacation costume?
No. That was my underwater sound. That was supposed to be bubbles going up. That probably sounded bad, didn't it?
That was a cool effect. Now I wonder why the person doing the transcription is going to transcribe that.
Yeah, okay. Well, the first one we got, and I was going to use this to say, speaking of transitions before timeouts and all that, Archer Sosens has a page transitions class out, and I've got... I'm trying to share. Oh, you've got that. No, I'm trying to share the screen. Why am I not? Are you seeing my? You're not seeing my.
I see. You just need to switch to the right page.
Okay.
Okay. There it goes.
No, that's not it. I had. Where did it go? I had
a demo.
Yeah, I had his demo up, which maybe I deleted. So I'm going to go.
There is a link on the package page.
Yeah, he's got a link here. But it's actually a little hard to find. Archers, not this, but I mean your, where did that go? Is it deciding? No, it's just going to be really slow.
It's next tab.
Yeah, but it's down here. It's examples in action. And then you have to click something else again, test one. This is an example of it. Hopefully this will come through decently in terms of there's a number of options here at the top, left to right, right to left, top to bottom, from bottom. So if you click that, it will do an actual transition. It's jerking a little bit.
Too many tabs open.
Okay, it drops down and then it comes up another page from the bottom. Yeah. Or you could do vertical flip and it will, as you see, do a vertical flip between, it's doing it between two different pages. So there's a whole library of these sorts of effects to use or transitions to use.
Very cool.
There you go. Back to you, Manuel.
Yeah, well, actually, I was wondering how did it work? Because you can implement some animation when the page is exit, when on and load, I think, or maybe some other related event, but when
I was trying to do a view source on that page, and I don't think I'm going to try that again because it
crashes your browser.
Well, it's interesting because I was thinking I'm in a different browser. No, I'm using Firefox for the Hangouts, and I was doing that on Firefox as well. So doing too much obviously in Firefox caused a problem, but. Yeah, I don't want to give away too much. I would encourage people to go to jsclasses.org and look at that page, look at that code themselves. If you give away too much, it's like, why would they buy a cow when they can just buy the book for free? Or why would they read it?
Or, you know. By the report, the summary for free.
Yeah, exactly. Exactamundo, as Fonzie would say. It's probably a little before your time, though.
No, probably it was also my time.
Okay.
Well. Anyway, it was yet another impressive class from Arthur's. Arthur's always publishes a very good batch of classes, but this time we just have one class to talk about this month, probably because he's also on vacation. Everybody on the North Hemisphere is on summer vacation, and
not me.
You know, right? But you never stop, right?
Can't keep a good man down. Actually, no. Can we erase that part? Never mind. Go on.
Well, I was wondering if you weren't you going to comment on another class or.
Well, I thought we would go back and forth. I thought that's how you wanted to work this. No. Okay. Keep your
head. Go ahead. Because
that's what it's come to. The other one this month of note was text reveal from. Nguru Mugendi.
From Kenya.
From Kenya, if we were going to say it, as the British would say it. Or Kenya, to appeal to the rest of America, United States of America. There's actually a demo page for this as well, too. And the demo page was...
related links. Oh, did you open already?
Yeah, I actually got the code, and I was running it. And look at that. Let's see. Did that? There we go. Look at that. The idea... I'm not sure this is working as I was expecting it to, but reading it, I'm not sure if there's another way. The idea here is it reveals text line by line as the text is scrolled over, supposedly useful for long textual pages. But when I do this, and it may jump a little fast for you, but when I scroll over it, it makes something. If I hover for more, it sort of keeps adding. As I scroll, it's adding more text.
Yeah,
maybe useful, and I guess I can imagine some other use cases for this. On this demo page, it doesn't quite feel as much because because there's so many of these, as I jump and hover over them, when I was doing it before, it was actually jumping the page around a lot more. It's not doing it as much now as it was, but
I said that it probably looks a bit confusing. Because it may. Its jump is...
I mean, technically, it's doing what it says, and I can understand what it's doing, but it may be that this effect would look better and present better in a more controlled, with a more specific demo. Like, I did it, because I'm imagining that and I'm also imagining that Nguru is a male, I'm imagining that he put this together probably for a particular project or a use case, and seeing it in that context would have helped me understand it better.
Yeah,
but that said, it's there and it does what it says.
Well, maybe in the next revision he puts on a more smooth animation when it expands the text, because I think it's probably too fast and showing all that additional text all at once.
Yeah.
And people may be wondering if they lost something.
Yeah. But again, and without knowing what the purpose behind it was, it may have been a very good solution for the original purpose. As a general purpose object or class, I would need to see more visual context.
Well, probably it was yet another of those solutions to not take so much space in pages and still show a bit of the beginning of the text, so people may evaluate if it is worth reading more. I don't know. I think that
could be
probably the purpose. Well, anyway, on my part, I also would like to mention a couple of classes. Let me screen share here. And starting from actually a framework called by JS Frame by Jose Manuel Carnero from Spain. And the basically what this framework seems is pretty much like what jQuery is. Basically a way to manipulate DOM elements, access them, locate them, and then do something with some plugins, like a few that he already provides for performing AJAX requests. And probably moving some DOM elements around the page, and well, I don't know what would be the motivation for Jose to develop this library, because since it seems pretty much like jQuery, maybe he just intended to develop a library that provides some of the functionality, but probably is not as long as jQuery, because jQuery, since it is has already evolved a lot, it is getting some weight, and we even mentioned in a previous episode that of the podcast that they are considering to take off some parts of the jQuery that support older browsers in future versions of the I think jQuery 2 or 2.1, I'm not sure. But maybe it was the purpose. Well, anyway, I think despite jQuery is very popular, it's not all to everybody, and it's always great to see alternatives, whether there is great overlap or not on jQuery. Well, I think at least that is my opinion on this. I don't know if you check this library, Michael, if you have any additional insight.
I don't. I've looked at it, but I haven't run it, so I don't have anything more to add.
Okay, so it's time to move on to the next package that I want to comment about. That this time is one by Ihor Komin. I'm not sure if I'm sure it's not the right way to pronounce his name, but okay, at least I tried. He's from Ukraine, and provided a package to manipulate dates, actually convert them, spell them in English words. The way he did it, it can cover dates that go from ranges of billions of years. And other than that, he also provided a PHP version of this class. So it does basically the same, but in PHP. And at least in PHP, there is that limitation of when you want to manipulate date, it's easier if the dates are not before 1970, which is the
timestamp. Yeah, Unix timestamp, yeah.
The epoch and origin, and everything else that goes before 1970, you need to have some custom code, because PHP does not provide much support.
The date time stuff, the date time, the PHP 5.1 date time classes and stuff, I think do a good job of pre-1970 stuff.
Yeah, that's something of the newer PHP versions. What I was talking about is, traditionally you would have to rely on some custom code to to manipulate. But in this case, it's just to convert dates to spell them. It goes to billions of years AD or BC, and I thought it was interesting to comment here. It's a pretty simple library, and maybe you knows if you have a need to spell a date, you can find a good use for this library.
I was kind of hoping to see something like June 12th, -7 billion BC. So there wasn't. It seems like at some point the granularity he stops talking, or the library stops talking about particular months and days, and just deals in years. Would have been nice to be able to maybe use this in some sort of like an Ajax calendaring thing to make a plan for May 9th, 7 million, and just you know, look on your calendar and see if you're busy that day.
Okay, I think not. Well, I don't think I would be available on that time.
But you can't be sure because you can't check in your calendar, is what I'm saying. So,
I see.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, the idea of this library is to use integers, very large integers, to store the dates, and then use the library to convert them to show them in English. It has several options to format the dates, and it's interesting because when you store in a database, you have to find a format that is suitable. And even in database that use the ISO format, the years only accommodate 4 digits. And
bastards. Those bastards. Always cutting corners.
Gosh. That's because it was not meant for a year range, is that you will not be alive.
Well, yeah, way to tell me how to use my own software. You know, I don't know what I'm going to use it for.
It won't be alive, but your descendants.
Well, okay, maybe I'm not, but the software should still be running. I should have an expectation that I can schedule something for the year 29,607.
Celebrate your 1 billionth anniversary of your
podcast. Yes,
podcast.
Yes. My billionth download. There you go.
Or maybe your birth.
Hey. Now you're just getting ageist. I don't want to get into age things right now because that's a little sensitive about that.
Okay.
The gray hair.
No more on a happy topic. We are going to move on finally to one of our last sessions, a regular section on which Michael talks about one of his reasons for being happy, which is his magazine, JS Mag.
Well, yeah, and as always, we're still kind of ahead of schedule, or not ahead, we're behind, we're on target with schedule, but there's a couple of... we've got Dr. Ginny Meyer has continued to contribute articles on various effects and transitions, and I think this is part of this stems from some of the lessons that she does, because she teaches a class on web technology in New York someplace. And I apologize, Dr. Meyer, I don't remember the actual name of where you're lecturing. So we've got a continuing series on that. And the one other piece that I know should be, I think it's actually going to production as we speak right now, is on Node.js clustering. So if you have multiple Node.js servers and you want to cluster them, there are some different techniques and options available. So we've got an article that will be going into more detail on that. And there's some others that I think are coming up, but I hate to say yes on something because we always make last minute changes.
Yeah.
So those are coming up in early September. We should have that issue out, I think, by September 3rd, which is a Monday next. Yeah. Really, a little over a week from now.
Yeah. Well, I just wanted other day I had a doubt about it. So when you subscribe to the magazine, you get 12 issues?
Well, subscription is using kind of traditional print publication scheduling. It'd be 12 issues 1 year. Usually people will start and, you know, if they want 12 issues, they'll start with the current month and they'll get 11 more in the future every single month. You could say, I want a series of 12 and go back and start at the beginning or start at any other time and say, I want this consecutive set of 12. So that's, you can essentially backdate a subscription to start in the past, which has worked out reasonably well so far. That's what that means.
But you can you still order individual
issues? Yes, if you want to go back and just say, I just want this one issue, which we do get sometimes, somebody, because an author will have referenced an article and they say, oh, I wrote this in September 2011, and they'll link to that, and people will come and just buy that one issue because they want that one, they want something from that particular author or they want that particular topic.
So, but is that part of the subscription, or we have to make purchase?
It's just a purchase. it's just a one off. That would just be a one off purchase.
Okay, that's interesting because I'm sure some people probably may be interested in specific topics that were covered in past issues, and at least with that information, I think they are clarified.
And at some point, we will have, it's not even under development because the tech is not that hard, but we will have a stronger search at some point. The idea of searching for particular topics or content. We did not start from day one capturing all this information, and now there are more than 3 years of content that we have not captured metadata on. So going back and recapturing all that metadata is the difficult part right now. But that will be, once that is all kind of recaptured, we'll be capturing it going forward and make the site searchable.
Okay, that's good. Okay, we have basically practically reached the end of the podcast.
We've come if you're going to comment. End of the podcast. You should have sung that with me. We could have duetted.
I could, but I do not recall that tune. Okay. Well, my culture is limited. Anyway,
your words, not mine.
My culture, right. I'm humble. And anyway, I was wondering, because you put your own label about IndieConf, if you wanted to comment anything new about it or...
Oh, well, yeah, IndieConf, our conference for independent webpreneurs, solopreneurs, independent freelance developers, designers, and so on. That is scheduled at November 17th. Is it November 17th? Let me just double check. It should be in my brain now, but it's for some reason. Yeah, November 17th, which is a Saturday. We've had a call for papers open, and that is closed. I am in the process of selecting first round of speakers. Some of the speakers will be coming back from previous years, and they're great. Probably about a third of the people that we've had in the past will be coming back again, and we've got some new speakers. I am in the process of selecting and then contacting people. So I try to do at least a phone call with everybody to make sure that that they're actually a real human being, and what they submitted, that they actually are competent to talk about it and so on. So I plan to have at least, let's say, the first round, maybe the first half of the speakers selected and posted at IndieConf.com this week.
Yeah.
So we got about 3 months, about 2.5 months from now.
So
tickets are on sale. You can go to the website. You can buy a ticket right now. Please go to the ticket and buy the site and buy a ticket right now.
Yeah, and support the independent developers.
Yes.
Okay, you are in the phase of picking the talks, right? And
yep.
You'll be announcing those that were selected.
Yep.
Soon.
Okay, yep, in the next week. And we've got, actually, I think I may have mentioned this before, we put up some videos. I probably will have a couple more videos up this week from last year's sessions. It's really just converting them. It takes a long time. But it kind of spans the breadth of, we had a session on public speaking, had a session on SEO, web SEO, session on publishing, and another session on just general business practices, which really covers the gamut of the types of things. It's some technical and some business, but everything organized around people who are independent.
Right. Well, that's good to know. Maybe you can come back to a future episode and talk more about the talks that were picked, and so people may decide if they would like to go, and based on the, that information.
Yeah, there's at least one JavaScript talk I know. There may be two. In terms of raw tech, that's about the level that we get at. We don't really get into PHP versus .NET versus anything, but everybody deals with JavaScript. So I think we'll have at least one, but maybe two JavaScript sessions.
Yeah, but there are many independent JavaScript developers that would be interested on the whole event, not just on JavaScript.
Sure. I mean, yeah, I was kind of saying in terms of there is some relation to our podcast here as well.
Yeah. Okay, well, basically we have ended our podcast. I just wanted to conclude. I don't know if you have it with you. Finally got your...
I did. I'm sorry. It's sitting in my wife's room right now, so...
Oh, she's monopolizing the...
Yeah, she's basically taking the elephant. So.
Well... I need to step away to show it again.
That was really generous. Manuel sent a elephant all the way from Brazil up to U.S. Thank you.
Yeah, well, it's my pleasure. It's a sort of a symbolic reward for your long-time cooperation. It's always a pleasure to have you with us, and sending you an elephant is the minimum that I could do to... to compensate for your trouble to be a co-host on this episode and also being helpful in many other aspects. Other than that, I just want to remind everybody else that is on the podcast that the Innovation Award of JS Classes site challenge is still going on. Since we didn't have much packages in this month being published, the progress was did slow down a bit, but is getting higher. It's on 85%.
You'll hit that by the end of the year, certainly. But
that's
ideally,
the expectation here. It says 12-13 January 4. It's the estimated goal. Consider the average of the last months, but usually this tends to go down as people get back from vacation and start submitting more packages. And this was related to with the elephant because the top five authors that send more. Top five contributors that send more packages considered notable until that date will get an elephant. So if you are interested, not just to get the elephant, but to expose your JavaScript work, this is all you have to do, send the packages to the site and also benefit from the exposure. And then also something else that I'll talk more about it in the upcoming months, something new that I'm working on that will provide a more rewarding experience to those that share their work in this podcast. Well, I think from my part, that's all for now. I don't know if you have any final remarks, Michael.
Oh, I do, but they would probably just get edited out anyway because I'm not sure you can actually say them cross continental borders. So I'll just leave it at that.
Okay. Well, thank you all for coming. See you next month. Bye.